This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. For generations, Indigenous children in the United States and Canada were forcibly sent to boarding schools. The move was part of a coordinated campaign to assimilate them into white Christian culture. And exactly what happened at those schools is still coming to light. Last week, the Kausis First Nation in Saskatchewan discovered 751 unmarked graves at the site of a former residential school. The find came just 1 month after more than 200 unmarked graves were uncovered at a former school in British Columbia. Now the U.S. is planning its own investigation of former boarding schools in the United States.
I come from ancestors who endured the horrors of Indian boarding school assimilation policies carried out by the same department that I now lead. The same agency that tried to eradicate our culture, our language, our spiritual practices, and our people. To address the intergenerational impact of Indian boarding schools and to promote spiritual and emotional healing in our communities, we must shed light on the unspoken traumas of the past, no matter how hard it will be. For more than a century, the Interior Department was responsible for operating the Indian boarding schools across the United States and its territories. We are therefore uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long. It's our responsibility.
That was Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, a member of the Laguna Pueblo, speaking at a virtual conference of the National Congress on American Indians last week. Joining us now to talk about the history of these schools and what happens now is Christine Dindisi McCleave. She's an enrolled citizen of the Turtle Mountain Ojibwe Nation. She's also the CEO of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, and she joins us from Minneapolis. Christine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Katrina Phillips, a history professor at McAllister College. She's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, and she joins us from St. Paul. Professor Phillips, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So I want to start with a voicemail we got from Tom.
While I was in Whistler, British Columbia to attend a scientific meeting in 2017, I visited the cultural center of the Squamish and Lilwat people. A special section of the cultural center, which was designated Where Are the Children, told the story of Canada's residential school system for the First Nations children. One display that I found particularly distressing was a letter in which the Canadian government was inviting an expert from the United States to come up and consult on how Canada could establish a system of residential schools based on what was seen to be the successful American model.
Professor Phillips, many Americans may not realize the Canadian boarding schools were modeled after those in the U.S. What's the backstory of these institutions?
So when we get into the later part of the 19th century, this is when the federal government switches up its federal Indian policy. And so instead of forcibly removing Native people from their lands and onto reservations, the government moves towards this two-pronged policy of allotment and assimilation. And a key facet of these assimilationist policies was aimed at Native children and the removal of Native children from their reservations to these boarding schools. And these boarding schools originated with a man named Richard Henry Pratt, who was a career military officer. And in about the 1870s, he had decided to experiment on Native prisoners of war, and he became convinced that this was the best way, if you will, to remove all elements of Indigenous culture. He has a speech from 1892 where he infamously said, "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one, and that high sanction of his destruction has been an enormous factor in promoting Indian massacres. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead. Kill the Indian in him and save the man." And so that's where we get boarding schools. And so Pratt is the founder of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which was founded in Carlisle, Pennsylvania in 1879, and hundreds of other schools would spring up across the country over the next few decades.
And how long were these schools operating? What's the time frame we're talking about?
So it kind of goes back and forth. I think Carlisle closed in 1918 and things like that. But a lot of these schools were in operation through the mid to late 20th century. There's one in Minnesota that was called Pipestone Indian Boarding School, and it didn't close until 1953.
Christine, what are the big differences between the Canadian schools and those here in the U.S.?
I would just like to say that there are also 73 Indian boarding schools that are still open today. So
where are those operating?
Those are all over the U.S. We have a list on our website at boardingschoolhealing.org. 15 of those 73 schools are boarding schools, so the others have switched to being day schools. The difference is that they are no longer that historical assimilative model of boarding school. In the 70s, with the self-determination era, we had a lot of legislation which reversed the original policy. So the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Language Revitalization Act, those pieces of legislation reversed the original policies which prohibited our language and culture and ceremonies. So it's important to note that these schools do still exist, and some of them are still open today. They no longer prohibit language and culture, they promote language and culture, but they still carry that legacy of the historical assimilative model of boarding schools.
And who are those schools operated by?
Some of them are operated still under the Bureau of Indian Education, and some of them have been turned over to tribal governments to operate. It depends.
So circling back to my earlier question, what are the big differences between Canadian schools and those here in the U.S.?
There's a lot of similarities and some differences. Most of the differences have to do with the federal government on either side of that border. So there are more similarities than differences, really, that they were both aimed at assimilating the Indigenous children. They were both aimed at eradicating the language and the culture.
Professor Phillips, how did children get to these schools?
So by 1891, the government made attendance at these schools compulsory. And initially, you know, when Pratt started recruiting children for these schools, his aim was to focus on the Native nations who were very open about their discontent with the federal government. And he would go to these nations and talk to their leaders. And essentially, their children became used as pawns. They were often held as hostages in order to ensure, you know, what the government would deem proper behavior from their parents and from their tribal nations. But it later becomes compulsory, which allowed federal officials to simply remove Native children from their homes. And in 1895, there were 19 Hopi men who were actually imprisoned at Alcatraz because they refused to send their children to boarding school. So that's kind of the extent the government went to in order to ensure that this assimilation process would touch as many Native nations and Native children as possible.
Coming up, the Department of Interior has promised to shine a light on these former boarding schools. We speak to the man coordinating that effort.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing the history and legacy of Indigenous boarding schools. And joining us now is Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, Brian Newland, which is part of the Department of the Interior. He's also a citizen of the Bay Mills Indian community, and he's coordinating the U.S. government's investigation into our own use of Native American boarding schools. Brian, welcome to 1A.
Ani, Jen, Miwich, thank you for having me here. And our tribe here at Bay Mills is also Ojibwe, so it's nice to be here with you and other Ojibwes this morning.
Well, what exactly are you looking for as part of this investigation?
We have an idea of where this is going to go, but it's hard to say exactly what we're going to find. There hasn't been an Indian person in the United States whose life wasn't shaped by the boarding school era somehow or some way. It has been every bit as defining of the relationship between Indian people and the United States as the loss or the theft of our lands. And so this is the first time the United States federal government has ever engaged in a comprehensive review. Some of the first things we're going to try to identify and secure are the records that the Department of the Interior has scattered around different sites around the country of who was actually enrolled at these schools, who made it home, and who died. And our hope is that we will be able to match up some of the names of people who died at these schools, some of the children who died at these schools, with burial sites. Unfortunately, I think there is a high likelihood that many of the burial sites we won't be able to associate them with a particular individual just because of how many burial sites there are, how many are unmarked. So we're trying to get our arms around the scope of what happened by getting these records secured and starting a review of them.
Who else will be part of this work? Because on one hand, you have the records held by the Department of the Interior, but as we heard from Christine, there's also the lived experience of people who were in these schools and their family members who were also impacted by this trauma.
Yeah. Since we've announced this initiative last week, we've had an outpouring of people reaching out to us at the department, offering to tell their stories or share information. And at some point, we are going to engage in tribal consultation, which is a process where the department speaks directly with tribal governments and their representatives to hear from them about how they think our work should proceed, how we should handle this information and protect it. And this is really a first step of identifying the truth and uncovering the truth about what happened in the boarding school era. And so as we get into this, there will be opportunities for tribes to meet with us and come forward and share their recommendations and their stories. And we're going to look to find ways to engage directly with survivors and their families.
Well, we read part of Javier's email earlier, but he also has a question for you, Brian. The email says, my mother was in boarding school in the 60s and early 70s and then ended up going on placement for her middle high school years. The Mormon placement program was where they would take natives away from their families to educate them. It also had the effect of separating the children from their cultures and heritage, but with a quote-unquote humanitarian approach. Will the Department of Interior do any research into other organizations and programs that also separated Native children from their families?
Well, there's no doubt that other religious institutions and private institutions played a role in the boarding school era. The first part, as I said before, this is the first step. The federal government has never engaged in this type of review before. And we want to start with ourselves. What are the records that we at the Department of the Interior have? Or what are the sites that we know about? What lands do we have access to? And uncovering that information and compiling it and beginning to tell the truth about what happened.
Christine, how do you hope the Department of Interior engages with tribal communities around these issues?
I think the government at times has had a very good process of nation-to-nation consultation, and I think this administration will do a good job. I think what's most important is providing support for those tribal communities. We've heard at the coalition, similar to what Brian just shared, you know, a lot of outpouring of people wanting to share their stories, sharing this unresolved grief. A lot of trauma is being triggered, and there's concerns about mental health. And so we've been asked quite a bit lately about the residential school survivor hotline that was established in Canada, and if we're going to have one here in the United States. So we would recommend that in addition to tribal consultation, there be some kind of hotline established for survivors and people to be able to reach out and talk to if they need help.
And Brian, what are the early conversations you're having about how best to support people as this trauma surfaces?
There's no doubt that this is this trauma continues for people across Indian country and tribal communities. And that has certainly been front of mind in our internal conversations within the federal government in trying to make sure that we do this in a thoughtful way and not recklessly. And when I say recklessly, I mean just proceed without regard to the mental and physical and spiritual well-being of survivors and their families. And that is something we're looking to try to make sure that we build into this effort. We're at the beginning stages. Welcome ideas and feedback, like what Christina just shared. Speaking for myself, I presently live here at Bay Mills Indian Community, in our tribal community. And I've heard from people directly since we announced this last week and what it means to them personally. The Secretary Holland, understands this. We know it because we've lived it in our communities as well. And it's something we want to make sure that we're giving thought to and being protective of people's well-being.
Will there be a hotline like what's been set up in Canada?
I don't know at this point, Jen, because we're just at the beginning of this process. If that is the best way to make sure that we are taking care of people's well-being, that's something we'll consider.
And I just have to wonder how much tension you feel in your role as assistant secretary, but also as a person who's part of this community that's been impacted by the federal government in such negative ways?
Well, it's challenging. This is my second stint at the Department of the Interior. And one of the things I learned from my first tenure at the department is that no matter where you come from or what's in your heart, when you step into these roles, you put on the uniform. So to speak, you are a representative of the United States federal government and all that comes with that, the good and the bad. And being mindful of that is something that I work at every day in making sure that I am using the role of the office that I occupy in a good way that brings healing, that brings accountability and progress to Indian country going forward.
That's Brian Newland. He's the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, which is part of the Department of the Interior. He's also a citizen of the Bay Mills Indian community. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Miigwech, thank you so much.
Christine, did anything stand out to you in what Brian said there?
I was really happy to hear that he talked about honesty and accountability from the federal government, as we just haven't had that, you know, for generations. It's been taught in our schools to all the children in the United States, this narrative that really isn't based in the truth, you know, the narrative of Thanksgiving and the narrative that, you know, the Indians just kind of disappeared. So I think it's long overdue, and I applaud this effort. I think it's time.
Christine, I know it's still very early in this process, but when we talk about accountability, for you at this moment, what shape might that take?
I think it comes in several forms. One is an official acknowledgement that this policy was
cultural genocide, if not just outright genocide. So I think that's going to be a huge step to see if this country can take. In Canada, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that they had on residential schools called it cultural genocide. So I think that acknowledgement is important to Indigenous peoples here in this country, but also like Katrina said, we need to know where our children are. So many of the children who were taken went missing, whose whereabouts are still unknown. They're in unmarked graves, and their relatives need those answers to move forward in a healing way.
And Professor Phillips, do we have any idea how many children died at these schools, or how they died, both in the U.S. and in Canada?
I think they're the best. I think scholars and communities have been able to do our estimates. One of the big pieces of this is really shoddy record keeping and a lack of caring. And so, you know, cemeteries were moved and, you know, things were built over cemeteries and things like that. And you don't put markers up on something you're trying to hide. And so, you know, the ways children died are also very varied. Schools were overcrowded and there wasn't great public sanitation. So epidemics often swept through the schools. Parents wouldn't be notified when their children got sick. And sometimes they wouldn't even be told when their children died. You know, they died from tuberculosis and measles, trachoma, the influenza pandemic. They suffered from abuse and malnutrition and overwork. And the Merriam report of 1928 said that death rates for Native students at boarding schools were 6.5 times higher than any other population at the time.
We're discussing the history and legacy of Indigenous boarding schools. We'll be back with more in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Let's get back to talking about the history and legacy of Native American boarding schools with this message from one of you.
Kumachi, Keshe, greetings. I am John Jahadi. I am of the Pueblos of Laguna and Zuni here in New Mexico. I am of the Turkey and Badger clans. I am the museum cultural educator at the Indian Public Cultural Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The history of the land on which the Indian Public Cultural Center exists begins with those indigenous peoples who for a millennia have always called the Southwest home. However, that history must also include that the land on which the Indian Public Cultural Center now resides was once also the Albuquerque Indian School, which was established in 1881. The rationale and mentality of the U.S. government's Indian boarding school policy was cultural side and eradication of those peoples who had established and sustained diverse permanent civilizations in what is now referred to as North America. We as Native people are ever mindful of those Native students who were taken without parental permission, without their consent, and traumatized by a policy of family separation. We are also mindful of the many Native children who were never able to be turned back home. I'm a descendant of an Indian boarding school student. My grandfather was taken to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. Because of his resilience, I am here. Because of his trauma of being separated from his family, his community, and his culture, I am here. His voice is heard through me. This is the narrative we at the Indian Public Cultural Center take in perpetuating the legacy of those who preceded us, and that it enables us the right to own our own stories.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, John. Here's another email we received from Guavarina, who says, my dad and his 9 siblings went to Catholic schools near our ancestral lands in southern Arizona, but they were able to go home at the end of the school days. Many people forget that Catholic schools were places that forcibly assimilated and abused Native children. My dad shared many stories of the abuse he endured. He had literal scars to prove it. His school picture shows him under a different name, not his given traditional name. They were abused on a daily basis for years on end and were forced to pray to the Catholic faith and consider their own ceremonies as pagan and their people as heathens. And DRK tweeted, in our family, the system worked. We are of Western Band Cherokee descent, but not enrolled. My grandmother was taken from her family and placed in a children's home. She was adopted by Anglos, creating a powerful rupture that still affects us. Professor Phillips, how has the traumatic legacy of these schools been passed down through the generations?
I think there are a couple ways that that's happened, and I want to refer back to Christine's earlier point about all of the stories that we don't know because of the trauma, because of the horrific conditions that these children endured. And the stories have come down through families, through the work of some incredible scholars. Brenda Child has written about boarding schools and things like that. And I think it's really important to recognize how big this loss really is. You know, so many of the current language and cultural revitalization projects exist because of what has happened. I mean, this is an incalculable loss. You know, the children who were lost would have been our leaders, our teachers, our elders. And so I think the desire for those stories and the stories that were lost, I think, is a really crucial piece. And I hope that by having these stories come to light in a broader purview, that, you know, folks who have not been touched by this, and, you know, as Brian said, every Native person in some way has been touched by this, but for kind of this moment of broader understanding and a reckoning of this history.
Christine, how do you even begin to reckon with or heal from this history when it's so difficult to wrap your arms, wrap your mind around what's been lost?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's difficult, it's complex, and there's different approaches, right? So we have been trying to move towards government accountability. We've been studying truth and reconciliation models. We've been advised by the former commissioners from the Canadian TRC. And, you know, that the academic models are kind of an easy way to structure some understanding, right? But it has to move from that cerebral understanding, from your head down to your heart, because there's definitely a huge aspect of this that is emotional and spiritual. And so when we look to Canada and what they did, obviously things begin with the truth. There has to be acknowledgement. Truth needs to be heard from the perspective of those who were harmed. So in addition to the Interior's initiative to locate the records, we do need to hear testimony from survivors and descendants in Canada during their commission. The regional public hearings that they held, they made sure to care for people. They had clinical support, mental health counselors. They had spiritual leaders there to pray with people. They also had clergy members, because some of our people are still, you know, part of the church. And so they had people there to care for them emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and physically. We need that here in the United States as well. So in addition to examining the records from a legal standpoint, an academic standpoint, we have to also consider cultural relevance, and we have to consider people's hearts and spirits as well as their minds. So we really need a holistic, inclusive strategy. And what we heard coming out of Canada was that they did a good job of doing that, of making it culturally relevant for people and taking care of them.
Christine, what do you say to people on the other side of these schools, those who worked at them or whose families worked at them?
I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is part of American history, not just Native American history. And yes, healing is needed on both sides, from those who experience these harms as well as those who are involved in inflicting those harms, whether it was intentional or in ignorance. I think the fact that we need to be asking our relatives about these stories is apparent. And you know, it's a difficult thing to address because I know there are a lot of people who, you know, would like to say, well, that wasn't me, that was my ancestors. But I think we all have a responsibility to acknowledge this history, to fully examine it and understand it, and particularly for non-Native people, to look at perhaps the implicit bias that exists. Statements like they were sent to these schools to keep them away from alcohol and other things. The reason that our communities struggle with those problems is simply, you know, because of this history. So statements like that need to be kind of unpacked and examined.
Christine, what more would you like to see done by the Biden administration?
Well, not necessarily by Biden's administration, but we are working with Senator Warren to reintroduce the bill that Congresswoman Hallin introduced last session for a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding Schools. I believe that will be essential after the Interior's investigation to take that work further.
That's Christine Dindisi McCleave, an enrolled citizen of the Turtle Mountain Ojibwe Nation. She's also CEO of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Christine, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And McAllister College History Professor Katrina Phillips. She's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Professor Phillips, thanks for speaking with us again.
Thanks for having me again.
Today's producer was Amanda Williams. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.